Hello, I'm Alton Banks for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. Well, we find ourselves, once we open the inside page, on the biz page of this week's TBJ. And under the heading of Now Charlotte comes the article, UNCC Rebrands Once Again. One of the Triangle's major advantages over Charlotte is its robust university system. Charlotte's colleges have graced the spotlight before, such as UNC Charlotte's dramatic run to the Final Four in 1977 and Oprah Winfrey's commencement speech at Johnson C. Smith in 2018. The 49ers were known as UNCC back in the day and were largely a commuter school outside of town. Later, in a move that confounded copy editors, the school decided it would drop the hyphen and become UNC Charlotte in an effort to differentiate itself from UNC Chapel Hill and others in the UNC system. Last year, the school topped 30,000 total students for the first time, and now it's trying to change its name. Starting today, just call us Charlotte, the school said, in a rebranding effort. Why now? So glad you ask. We're about to be 75. We know who we are, and we know where we're going. And in fairness, the school and region around it are experiencing explosive growth, and the city's commuter rail that connects the university to downtown gives it a hip, urban feel. And under the heading of Dollar Flow, the article, PPP Fraud Could Total in Billions. It wasn't a big surprise that the almost $800 billion Paycheck Protection Program would lead to cases of fraud, but a new study shows just how much. The study from the University of Texas at Austin found that more than 1.8 million of the 11.8 million loans approved under the program, designed to keep workers on the payroll, were potentially fraudulent or misreported. Those loans represent $76 billion. The report looked at four primary indicators to identify potentially fraudulent loan applications: non-registered businesses, multiple loans at a residential address, abnormally high implied compensation relative to industry and geographic norm, and large consistencies between jobs reported. And under the heading of Arms Race comes the article, ACC Seeks Help in Holding Off the SEC. An underdog's chances are, by definition, slim. But maybe three underdogs versus one favors versus one favorite is more of a fair fight. That's what the Big Ten, ACC, and Pac-12 are hoping for, as the three conferences announced an alliance August 24th that will pave the way for a future scheduling partnership and collaboration on other matters. Each of these three leagues would take exception to being called an underdog, but it's hard to argue that the Southeastern Conference, already dominant in the all-important revenue-generating sport of football, is anything other than a super-duper conference after the additions of the University of Texas and the University of Oklahoma in the coming years. Now, other conferences are aiming to protect their schools from departing for the SEC and its potentially greener revenue pastures, and hope the alliance will help in that mission. And under the heading of NC Impact comes the article, Scammers Rake in Billions. A new accolade for North Carolina. The state has been named the 17th most scammed state by socialcatfish.com. The study, which used data from the FBI, IC3, and the FTC, found that overall victims 20 and younger grew by 156% from 2017 to 2020, compared to 112% by seniors. That's as seniors remain the most victimized group, with more than 105,000 victims losing $966 million in 2020. Overall, a record $4.2 billion was lost to online scams in 2020, according to the report. And under the heading of National Scope comes the article, Raleigh Lawyer Takes On Key Role. A Raleigh lawyer is taking on a big assignment with the American Bar Association. Christopher Browning Jr., a trial and appellate lawyer with Troutman Pepper, has been named chair of the ABA's Judicial Division. He assumed the role August 10th. The Judicial Division plays a key role in supporting judges, advocating for them, and helping to ensure that all Americans have equal and fair access to the justice system. The judicial system also speaks out on the protection of judges across the globe, such as female judges in Afghanistan. And finally, on the biz page for this week's Triangle Business Journal, under the heading of New Look, comes the article, Downtown South, New Designs Out. The architect's firm, tapped to lead the design of the upcoming Downtown South development, has released new designs for the project spearheaded by a Raleigh native. Recently, international architecture firm Ten Design unveiled some new details for the master plan, calling for a mix of offices, hotel, retail, and residential areas that includes a design for a 20,000-capacity soccer stadium and a virtual reality center. Design partner Ted Givens, who studied architecture at NC State University, is guiding the company's efforts on the project after spending much of his career in Asia. Givens is leading Ten Design's U.S. and Latin America office from its Miami office. Raleigh represents an important milestone for Ten Design, as it is our first major project in North America, Givens says. It's particularly special to me, as it allowed me to transfer a lot of the learnings I gathered from many years working abroad in Asia and around the world to my hometown in North Carolina. The design for Raleigh provides a mix of simple buildings that merge with the natural landscape and iconic pieces that activate the master plan. The design also calls for a bridge loop that would enclose the development and improve accessibility within Downtown South and the rest of the city. Downtown South is Ten Design's first major project in North America. The company also has upcoming projects in Cary and Sanford, as well as in Pennsylvania, Florida, and in countries around the world. Next, we turn to the tech and aviation page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And on that, we find, under the heading of Morrisville, the article, Tech HQ Quietly Lands Here. A publicly traded networking giant has quietly moved its official headquarters to the Triangle, at least on paper. Extreme Networks, a $1 billion technology firm based in San Jose, California, now lists its Morrisville site at 2121 RDU Center Drive as its global headquarters and securities filings. Katie Motley, Chief Administrative and Sustainability Officer for Extreme Networks, confirms the change, telling Triangle Business Journal that the company recently decided to relocate its headquarters as the company has become more virtual and highly distributed since the pandemic began. Moving our headquarters to Morrisville made sense logistically, but we're also excited because it's a thriving hub of technology and tech talent, Motley says. The firm designs, develops, and manufactures both wired and wireless network infrastructure equipment. Extreme Networks is not the first company to quietly make this kind of move in the wake of the shift to remote working. Last year, communication software firm Avaya Technologies relocated its headquarters from California to Durham without a lot of fanfare. And Phreesia, a technology firm in the healthcare space, made a similar move, relocating its principal executive offices to Raleigh from North Carolina. In both of these cases, executives cited remote working trends as precipitating the move. And under the heading of Based in Durham, the article, Quantum Computing Firm Closes on Cash. A Durham startup trying to use quantum computing to speed up drug development has raised nearly $3 million in new funding. Polaris Quantum Biotech has closed more than $2.9 million in equity, securities filings show. The year-old startup secured the fund from 16 investors, and according to the filing, more could be coming as the round is actually capped at $3.8 million. Polaris is developing a drug discovery platform using quantum computing, one that could speed up the process of pharma development by scanning billions of molecules quickly. Polaris's mission statement is bold: to revolutionize drug design by marrying quantum computing with artificial intelligence and precision medicine. Its website claims the firm will produce up to 100 drug blueprints per year, shrinking the lead time for preclinical drug candidates from 5 years to 4 months, enabling real-time adaptability to the precision medicine market. And its CEO, chemist Shahar Kynan, is no less bold in an interview. "We're not interested in being a service company," she says. "We're interested in developing our own assets and building a portfolio of solutions. To do it, Polaris needs to scale," Kynan says. "That's where the latest funding round comes in. The 5-person firm will be able to add to its team, and it will be able to make inroads in realizing its vision," she says. "We're building a portfolio of assets," Kynan says. And we turn next to the real estate page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And on it, we find the article, Park Point Lands Cree LED HQ. A lighting products and services firm has signed on to space at one of Research Triangle Park's largest life sciences campuses. Cree LED is taking 89,167 square feet of space at Trinity Capital's Park Point Creative Office and Life Sciences campus. The space will serve as the firm's new headquarters following the company's recent sale to Smart Global Holdings. Cree LED was the LED business arm of Durham-based Cree before SGH bought the company in a deal announced last October that closed in March. The new tenant plans to move into the grid building in the third quarter of 2022. The space will house around 300 workers. "We welcome Cree LED to the growing community at Park Point, which remains the largest adaptive reuse project in the Southeast," says Jeff Sheehan, partner at Charlotte-based Trinity Capital. "With more than half of the space leased before completion, we are confident that the collaborative nature of the campus, coupled with its exceptional amenities, will continue to get the attention of industry-leading companies like Cree LED and ultimately help them to attract and retain top talent." Cree LED's operations currently based at 4400 Silicon Drive in Durham. The lease brings Park Point to 56% occupied. Cree's decision to sell its LED division was part of the company's focus on its semiconductor business. Cree LED joins 2 other tenants at the park. In January, Trinity Capital announced Charles River Laboratories of Massachusetts signed on as a tenant at Park Point, taking up 70,369 square feet on the first and second floors in the park's 3-story Edge West building. In 2020, the property landed its first tenant when California-based Grail Incorporated signed it on to 200,000 square feet of space at the park, serving as an anchor tenant. In 2019, Trinity Capital announced a $120 million project to redevelop the office park into a new life sciences and creative office hub. Altogether, Park Point will feature 650,000 square feet of space. understand under the heading of mixed use. The Fenton Project in Cary targets spring opening. Work on Cary's massive Fenton development is well underway as crews top out buildings in the project's first phase, and developers say they're on track for an April opening. Developers Hines, Columbia Development, and USAA Real Estate have spent the last year plus transforming the 69-acre site into a large mixed-use destination with office and mixed-use apartment buildings rising six stories overlooking amenity and retail space. Fenton recently celebrated the topping out of its first phase, which includes 345,000 square feet of retail, restaurants, and entertainment space, and 200,000 square feet for offices. And under the heading of residential, the article proposal could bring up to 1,100 homes to Raleigh. The owners of a large assemblage in North Raleigh are seeking to make way for a project that could bring over 1,000 homes to the area. Earlier this year, the owners of 212 acres filed a rezoning request with the city to allow for the development of a new mixed-use project calling for up to 1,100 residential units plus commercial uses. The site spans 212 acres at 5604 Kyle Drive East to 6515 Buffalo Road, south of the Highway 401 interchange with Interstate 540. The land is largely undeveloped. Documents filed with the city did not list how much commercial space could be included in the project. At least one document refers to the project as Buffalo Reserve. Property owners listed in the filing include a collection of LLCs, families, and individuals. Filings with the city did not name a developer or contract buyer. Well, next we turn the page and we get to one of the newer sections of Triangle Business Journal, the section entitled On Greater Triangle Growth. And under the heading of Major Need comes the article, Industrial Space on the Way. Work is progressing on one of the largest mixed-use projects in the Triangle. Selma-based Adventure Development has broken ground on Building 100, the first facility to get underway at Eastfield Business Park in Johnston County. The business park is part of the more expansive Eastfield Crossing project outside Selma, which totals approximately 3 million square feet of industrial, retail, medical, and housing space. Building 100 will bring much-needed inventory to Johnston County, which is starving for industrial space. The desire to build it came out of the fact that there was no inventory in that industrial category in the Johnston County market, says Kevin Doherty, president and owner of Adventure Development. Building 100 will be 135,000 square feet, and Doherty expects the shell to be complete in March. He envisions advanced manufacturing or warehouse operations functioning out of the space. ARCO Design and Build is providing design and construction services, and Phoenix Commercial is handling the leasing. Eastfield is one of the most ambitious projects in the Triangle. As Doherty says, the only thing not included in this development is traditional office space. Not that we wouldn't, he quickly adds. We just didn't necessarily see this as that kind of location. Eastfield will include about 225 single-family homes, 300 to 350 multifamily units, as well as hotel and medical space, and room for major retailers. He declines to name specific retailers yet that have expressed significant interest, but says they are names that everybody would recognize and are currently not in the market. In the next 18 to 24 months, we should see a flurry of activity at the site. Adventure Development is working on its single-family and multifamily residences, the first phase of retail, and a hotel that was ready to go to bid when COVID-19 hit in early 2020. The hotel will take 12 months plus to build, so I don't see the hotel opening and operating until 2023 at the earliest, Doherty says. I see the first phase of retail opening in April of 2023. I see single family on the ground definitely in 2022, and multifamily the same way. I see them potentially closing before year end and being under construction in 2022. We've got a lot of moving parts, and I'm excited to get them all activated. Work is progressing on Old North State Food Hall, too. The food hall will be located in the Triangle East Collaborative Building within Eastfield, and a company run by a renowned chef was recently brought on to manage the space. I think we have enough land assembled that we can put together a nice, quality, mixed-use project, Dory says. And under the heading of 53 acres comes the article, Greensboro Developer Makes Another Buy in Smithfield. A Greensboro developer that already has a sizable presence in Johnston County added to its portfolio recently an LLC that shares an address with Samet Corporation, purchased 53.21 acres off West Market Street in Smithfield for more than $2.3 million, according to a deed dated August 18. Brian Hall, Director of Development for Samet, says the purchase is part of the firm's ongoing investment and development in West Smithfield Industrial Park. The company has made other purchases in the area recently, notably a $5.8 million buy for 233 acres this spring along Market Street. West Smithfield Industrial Park aims to be a logistics hub for the Triangle and has one of the industry's biggest names coming on board soon. One of its major tenants will be Amazon, which was announced earlier this year. And finally, on the Greater Triangle Growth page, under the heading of Some Exceptions, comes the article, Greater Triangle's Population is Exploding. The Greater Triangle grew substantially during the 2010s, but the geographic concentration of that growth was not evenly spread. The core counties of Wake and Durham and southern hotspots such as Johnston and Chatham added tens of thousands of people in the last decade, according to new U.S. Census data. But counties to the north saw population stay roughly the same or even decrease. Granville County saw its population increase 1.8%, well below the state's 9.5% growth rate. Person, Vance, Warren, and Halifax counties lost residents. Warren and Halifax each lost 11.1% of their population, which represents reductions of 2,330 and 6,069 people, respectively. Vance County saw its population shrink 6.3% as its number of residents went from 45,422 in 2010 to 42,578 in 2020. Next, we turn to the retail and restaurants page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of staffing comes the article, No Workers, No Restaurant. This could be sad news if you live in Cary. A breakfast and lunch restaurant in Cary is the latest blow of the pandemic after a staffing shortage led the owners to permanently close the doors. Briggs in the Tryon Village Shopping Center went out of business August the 18th, and there are no plans to relaunch what used to be a busy dining establishment, says founder David Brigham. The location's franchise owner, Mike and Lisa Carner, decided to end operations after 11 years, Brigham says, and they sold the restaurant equipment to a neighboring business, Sports Bar Craft Public House, which has also taken over the lease. Brigham says extended federal benefits, $300 a week for people receiving state unemployment, are the reason the location's usual staff of 30 workers had dwindled fewer than a dozen. The federal supplement is set to expire in early September, and like other restaurant owners, Brigham hopes that will lead more people to return to work. It was hurtful to close a restaurant because they would rather sit at home than actually work for a living, says Brigham, adding all Briggs employees make at least $15 an hour and receive free food during their shifts. Brigham says all five of his Brig locations had record sales for May through July, despite changing COVID-related protocols. But the staffing shortage, in addition to rising food costs and supply issues, continues to strain restaurant owners and operators. Brigham and his wife Susan started the company 32 years ago. They own the Raleigh location, and former employees own the locations in Wake Forest, Durham, and the other one in Cary at Maynard Crossing. David Burson, chief economist at Nationwide Insurance, says employers could get relief soon after the federal unemployment supplement expires September the 6th. The impact will be lagged, he says. It will start in September, and it will be increasingly stronger over the next year, but it will start small. With the elimination of the extended unemployment benefits, those workers who could make more by not working than working, that will come to an end. That should give people an incentive to get back in the labor force. Also, more parents could return to the workforce after children return to school this fall. Also on the retail and restaurants page, under the heading One of Many, comes the article, Carbro Shop Sees Food Traffic Tick Up. Activity has picked up for small business owners with brick-and-mortar locations in recent months, but they hope COVID-related setbacks don't slow the momentum. Overall foot traffic at small businesses is up more than 25% in North Carolina and 53% across the country since January, according to data firm Zenrich, a marketing software company based in San Francisco. Customers have returned to 13 West, a retail shop at Carr Mill Mall in Carrboro, owner Haley Bunting says. The store offers women's apparel, gifts, and children's clothing. In 2016, Bunting decided to start her business as a mobile shop. In 2019, she moved 13 West to the Triangle, where she switched to a storefront with online operations. Recently, she expanded to a larger space a few doors down in the shopping mall, and she's also running a pop-up shop at Boxyard RTP. At the Carrboro store, foot traffic is normally down during the summer months, but the shop was especially busy in June, Bunting says. With students returning to UNC Chapel Hill, she expects to see a boost in business. And also on the retail and restaurants page under the heading of Growth Plans comes the article, Raleigh's Path Goal, acquired by New York firm. A pair of human resources and staffing services companies plan to expand their reach with the recent acquisition of Path Goal Employer Services in Raleigh. Prestige PEO of New York purchased the business from Headway Workforce Solutions on August the 16th. The companies declined to share the financial details. Each company is a professional employer organization, that is a PEO, that pools small to medium-sized businesses together to provide them with benefits and services that would commonly be available to larger companies, says Andrew Lubesch, the CEO of Prestige PEO, one of the largest PEOs in the U.S., according to the company. And a frequent listener to the Triangle Business Journal will know that each week there is an executive voice column. And this week's executive voice belongs to Natalie Hawkins. Hawkins is the executive director for the Moore County Partners in Progress. Before that, she was assistant village manager for the village of Pinehurst. Her hometown is Charleston, South Carolina. Natalie Hawkins vividly remembers the first time she visited Moore County. She was a graduate student at UNC Chapel Hill, staying at the Pinecrest Inn, and felt like she entered another world. "I thought I had stepped back in time," Hawkins says. "I thought I was in the middle of a Norman Rockwell painting in living color." Moore County is still considered a golf mecca and home to many retirees, but families relocating to the area especially with Fort Bragg half an hour away, have injected youth and a different dynamic into the community. Word's getting out about Moore County. The Tri-Cities area of Pinehurst, Southern Pines, and Aberdeen was named the number one micropolitan area in North Carolina earlier this year, according to a study by economic research firm Polycom Corp. Moore County's population grew 13.5% between 2010 and 2020, according to U.S. Census data, faster than the 9.5% growth clip for the state overall during that time frame. Community leaders such as Hawkins are charged with the balance of growing while maintaining the county's charm. Hawkins took over as executive director of Moore County Partners in Progress, the county's economic development arm, in May, but is no stranger to the Sandhills. She worked for the village of Pinehurst for more than 20 years. So here's the Q&A part of the executive voice column. What's the biggest surprise in how Moore County has changed? Her answer, the impact of the Fort Bragg realignment and the influx of military into our community. When those changes were announced several years ago, that the Army was going to close some bases and move some operations to Fort Bragg, we kept on hearing, this is going to affect Moore County. What really happens is the military community is such a tight network that when they get stationed at Fort Bragg, they come to live here because of our schools, health care, and great quality of life. The word gets out. What businesses would you like to attract? We're looking at two key sectors to focus efforts on right now. The first is the golf cluster, with the U.S. Golf Association's announcement that it's going to put Golf House Pinehurst HQ2 here, and the golf-related businesses that have a presence here. The other area is medical and life sciences. We've got phenomenal healthcare facilities here. First Health, Pinehurst Surgical Clinic, Pinehurst Medical Clinic, the Reed Heart Center, and we just broke ground on a new $65 million cancer center, which you don't see in rural North Carolina. We think businesses in those two sectors would be particularly attractive to this area. Outside of the three main towns, where do you see the most opportunity for growth? Her answer, Carthage, hands down. There's a lot of growth going on in Vass, too, but I think Carthage is going to grow the most next because you can get on 501 up to Sanford, and it's 20 minutes closer to Raleigh than Pinehurst is. Vass is growing because of its proximity to Fort Bragg. If you look at where housing is really booming, you're seeing a lot of housing growth in Vass. The 15501 corridor is slated by the DOT to be four-laned, so once that's four-laned, I think Carthage is going to experience a tremendous amount of growth. So what's the timeline for making that road four lanes? Right now, everything's after the U.S. Open in 2024. So in 10 years, how will your county be different? Her answer, we're going to have improved road infrastructure for sure. I think that the NC Department of Transportation will have made those improvements to 15501 and some improvements to U.S. 1. There are a lot of road projects on the horizon. I think Pinehurst is going to have a lot more attention because of the U.S. Championships, and with every U.S. Open, it just opens the door further and further to the world of who we are in Moore County. 10 years from now, we'll have a lot more residents, and the growth from the Southern Pines Pinehurst area will go more north, so you're going to see Pinehurst and Carthage coming together. Do you think Moore County Regional Airport will have commercial service by then? Her answer, I would love to say that Moore County Airport will have commercial service. I think that with the recurring U.S. Opens and the USGA headquartered here, I think there's demand for it today. I just don't think the commercial airlines are willing to foot that bill. So maybe there's a boutique airline. That's what I see. I see a boutique airline's commercial service running back and forth to Raleigh and Charlotte. And the final question for Hawkins, what keeps you up at night? Her answer, The fear that community leaders or business leaders will make decisions that may be right in the short term, but are not going to be benefiting long term to our community. Decisions about supporting transportation improvements that are needed, and although they may be controversial today, it's really what the community needs long term. I look to the future, and I can see the changes on the horizon. And they're not just changes from the standpoint of growth in the amount of people, but we're changing as a community in terms of demographics. We are attracting younger people to this community. People say Pinehurst is a retirement community. It is no longer a retirement community. Next, we come to this week's issue of the series called 52 Shades of Success. As you may know, this year-long project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. And this week's article is entitled Working to Make a Difference. Who you are makes a difference. Reuben and Nikin Shaw, brothers and co-CEOs of Polyzen, the company their father started in 1991, say this is a quote their father says often, and it underscores the messages of diversity and inclusion that Tillich Shaw instilled in everyone, from his two sons who assumed leadership of Polyzen in 2018 to the associates working in his company, some of them for 10, 15, or 20 years. Who Tillich is starts with the 1968 journey from India to the City College of New York, where he earned a master's degree and then went to work for the Upjohn Company, working in Europe before returning to the U.S. When Dow Chemical acquired Upjohn's polymer chemical operations in 1985, the Shaw family faced a relocation from Connecticut to Michigan. Instead, Tillich decided to start a company that would explore applications for polyurethane, similar to what he had been doing in Europe with Upjohn. He saw opportunities for medical applications, and he wanted to find any possible way to manipulate and process polyurethane polymer, Reuben says. With capital raised from friends and family and an entrepreneurial mindset, Tillich started a business. First as a consultant based in Connecticut, then relocating to North Carolina in 1990 and launching Polyzen in 1991. On the topic of diversity and inclusion, my father was a minority coming from India with an entrepreneurial spirit, coming to Europe, communicating with a bunch of different cultures, moving to the U.S. and assimilating, Reuben says. Starting the polymer company went beyond solving problems technically. It was also about assimilating into the southeastern United States and creating relationships with local universities and individuals, domestic companies, and global trading partners. It was about being able to mesh this whole puzzle together of different cultures, different backgrounds, different races. Tillich has a knack for being the coach, for being inclusive of everybody, Reuben says. And that's the environment that exists within Polyzen, where the team of associates includes individuals from at least 15 different cultures, and everyone is encouraged and empowered to voice their ideas. We're all in these different positions, executing these different roles, but at the end of the day, we're all people, Nikin says. We don't see people as titles. And people don't like me saying this, but I think titles are cheap. Titles are more for the outside. On the inside of the company, inclusion is about fostering collaboration among all the players. When we have an idea, it's about getting everybody's input, not just driving from the top, Reuben says. We've been trying to evolve the culture and bring folks from various parts of the organization, from us at the top to our technicians. As for building diversity within the team, he says they never segregated their recruiting strategy. We never said we were going to hire white, black, Asian, or by gender. Anybody who has a passion that resonates with our local values could have a place of employment here. The company has 75 employees and is in hiring mode. Market dynamics had the business fluctuating across the pandemic months, which resulted in some layoffs. We did have a slight reduction in staff, Nikan reports. We offered everyone that we let go their job back. Part of their ability to ramp back up was because Polly's and partnered with NC State University and Triangle Hospitals to support needs for personal protective equipment, that is PPE. We were able to innovate and deliver polymer components they needed because a lot of the PPP being used were single-use disposable plastics or polymer-type products, whether it was covering on bed sheets or face shields, he explains. Now, the company has returned to more of its core products, which are often Class 1, Class 2, and 3 medical devices that are used for surgical procedures or long-term implants. That's about 95% of our business, Nikan says. We work with small startups to many of the large medical device OEMs like Medtronic and Boston Scientific. Historically, healthcare has been fairly recession-proof, but it is not pandemic-proof. When hospitals shut down to focus on COVID, reducing or eliminating elective procedures, it impacted our customers' businesses. Some customers continued to buy, some slowed down, and some had to stop purchasing during that time. Since elective procedures began coming back this year, many of Polygen's products have returned to pre-pandemic volumes. Revenue slumped during 2020, but across 2019 to the present, sales have remained essentially flat, roughly $20 million annually. Now we're faced with another challenge. Global supply chains are very uncertain, Rubin notes. Everything from raw material to shipping, all of that is impacted. Demand is not the problem. Everything is just delayed, and the ability or inability to respond, that's industry agnostic, and it is global. Polygen works with suppliers all over the world. And while the situation has not become so dire that a company has had to consider locating its suppliers in closer proximity, it is not out of the conversation, Rubin says. The company's growth strategy is focused on helping its customers bring products to life. To a large extent, Polygen's success hinges on the success of its customers. As a service-focused organization, the only way we grow is when our customers grow, Rubin says. Everything we do is around polymers, and we have a host of processing capabilities in-house, from extrusion to welding to coating of products, Nikan adds. We're working on a variety of applications in cardiovascular and with artificial organs. And we do a fair amount of work in the gastrointestinal space with various types of balloons or stents or coated products. We do a lot of products in the general surgery space, from organ retrieval bags to space-making products during surgery. The other side of Polygen's business is a new product development, and some of the company's work with well-funded or venture-backed startups continued across the pandemic, with the exception of those that were involved in clinical trials. There's a lot of capital in the marketplace, so we're seeing growth in new projects, Nikan says. We've been in existence around 30 years and have some deep-rooted relationships with large OEMs, as well as the mid-sized startups. What we are also seeing is that a lot of these OEMs have the marching order to increase their supplier base with minority-owned businesses. As a minority-owned supplier certified through the National Minority Supplier Development Council, Polygen is working to be added to those databases. We are second-generation, minority-owned, and have been established here for 30 years, Nikan says. For international companies that want to become familiar with the local ecosystem, we serve as a resource and a network to connect with businesses and universities here locally. And that all ties into inclusiveness. We have a passionate group of folks here in the Triangle who agree that minority-owned businesses are critical to the success of any ecosystem. Now, there are a couple of sidebar articles associated with this 52 Shades of Success article this week, and one of them is entitled Big Three Schools Show Diverse Enrollments. Class of 2025 is all about diversity and inclusion. Among the 1,752 students in the Duke University freshman class, 55% are women. 56% identify as students of color. 10% of the class are foreign nationals, representing 85 foreign countries. UNC Chapel Hill welcomes 4,326 first-year students, representing 44 states and 40 countries. 5% are international students. 32% have at least one parent who was born outside the U.S. 22% are first-generation college students. More than 40% of incoming students identify as a person of color. Across the university, 59% of students are females. At NC State University, the 4,665 incoming freshmen come from 40 states and 9 countries. In the class of 2025, 50.3% are female. Roughly 28% are students of color, but only 2% are international students. That was one sidebar article. Here's the second on healthcare. COVID-19 vaccine rate improves among minorities. As of August the 16th, the Centers for Disease Control reported race ethnicity was known for 58% of the people who had received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. As of that date, 72% of adults in the U.S. had received at least one dose. Among those whose race was known, 58% were white, 17% were Latinx, 10% were black, 6% were Asian, 1% were American Indian or Alaska Native, and less than 1% were Native Hawaiian. However, the vaccination rate was increasing among minority populations. In the 14 days leading up to the report, 26% of vaccines went to Latinx people, 15% to blacks, and 4% to Asians. And on a news page today, we find the article, Duke Spinout Raises Stakes for Polio-Based Cancer Treatment. The pieces are starting to fall into place at a Duke University spinout studying how technology derived from a polio vaccine might cure hard-to-treat cancers. Boosted by a recent $43.4 million funder, Durham-based Starry Oncology has the cash runway to get it through at least the first half of next year, says CEO Matt Stober. That's enough time for data to come back on a series of studies for its treatment. But the challenges, too, are stacking up in the background. The stakes are high and getting higher, as the startup has decided to expand its oncology trial. With COVID causing capacity constraints across the entire industry, it's a crazy time to be building a company, Stober admits. Stober, who took the CEO seat last year, has been tasked with taking the firm to the next level, outside of academia, and into an actionable phase where its technology can really make a difference. But COVID complications are causing administrative challenges. Astari isn't facing the same COVID-related patient enrollment entanglements as some other clinical-stage pharma firms, but is seeing competition for capacity. Much of the industry's capacity is being earmarked for COVID-19 vaccines, making it more difficult to fill vials and source ingredients. Astari, which partners with Fujifilm Diosynth Biotechnology for its manufacturing, has not seen a major impact when it comes to executing clinical trials, but the costs have gone up as a result of the capacity constraints. Finally, we reach the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and this week's journal is a little unusual in the fact that the editor-in-chief, that's Sugata Mukherjee, did not write the editorial notebook today. Instead, he has a guest columnist named Jeff Korzenik, who happens to be chief investment strategist of the Fifth Third Bank. Korzenik's article is entitled, Three Steps to Start a Second Chance Hiring Program. employers should consider second chance hiring, the practice of employing people with criminal records, and a framework for addressing the three main objections to such hiring. With the rationale acknowledged and objections overcome, the focus for employers becomes implementation, which can be defined in three broad steps. Step one, build knowledge and partnerships. Successful second chance hiring requires an intentional effort and investment. Much of that initial outlay is not a monetary cost, but rather a commitment of time to identify legal barriers, potential candidate referral, and employee support resources, and to educate your team. Some industries do have regulatory constraints that could limit your hiring, and it's important to identify any limitations, but generally these prohibitions are less restrictive than employers believe. Knowing any hard limitations, employers should seek out potential partners, typically nonprofits or government agencies. These are the organizations that both provide referrals of appropriate candidates or help provide some of the support services that will allow these team members to thrive, for example, transportation or housing assistance. Another helpful education step is to visit with a successful second chance employer to observe their process, learn from their experience, and witness the proof of concept of second chance hiring. Given that your human resource professionals will be on the front line of this work, consider having them enroll in and earn the Getting Talent Back to Work certification, offered free by the Society of Human Resource Management. Step two, tear down those walls. Even well-intentioned companies may have ingrained barriers to hiring people with criminal records. For example, committees that assess such applicants in a process called secondary review are typically staffed by professionals whose career interests may bias them toward declining any candidates with any controversial aspect, including line of business managers who directly suffer from the labor shortage, or tasking a committee member with advocating for specific candidates can help balance the scales. Even before the applicant review, the recruiting process can be filled with steps that inadvertently stand in the way of utilizing this valuable talent pool. Level Set, a consulting firm that works with employers to implement second chance hiring practices, created an online 10-question self-assessment for employers that helps uncover potential obstacles from recruiting through onboarding and beyond. While not every one of Level Set's recommended practices will be a fit for every employer, this is an easy, fast, and free resource to help examine potential barriers. And finally, step three, commit with accountability. Every business leader knows that intentions and structure don't always get the job done without accountability. The key is that some kind of commitment and accountability are necessary to overcome institutional inertia and the particular hesitancy associated with hiring people with criminal records. Most of the successful second-chance employers that I've studied started modestly and built from early learning, but the key was a commitment. Whether a pilot program or part of the normal hiring process, these businesses have found that the experience speaks for itself. Second chance hiring is a path to loyal and engaged workers. To gain that experience yourself, you have to start. And the other article on today's Viewpoint page is written by Patrick McHugh. McHugh is a research manager of the Budget and Tax Center with the North Carolina Justice Center. McHugh's article is entitled Improving Labor Market, But a Long Way to Go. July labor market figures indicate the pace of job growth has picked up in recent months following the passage of the American Rescue Plan, but the future pace of recovery is far from certain. In addition to being fragile, the current recovery is uneven. With job losses persisting in many of the lowest-paying industries, while some high-wage sectors have exceeded pre-pandemic employment levels. Federal investments made through the American Rescue Plan have certainly helped stimulate the economy and address some of the harm created by COVID-19, but if leaders at the state and local level don't continue to invest in an equitable recovery, recent progress could easily falter. It's also worth noting these data collected before the surge in cases driven by the Delta variant really took off, so we'll have to see how things evolve in the coming months. Economic challenges facing North Carolina include a tale of two labor markets. The headline employment figures mask a deep divide that's persisted throughout the pandemic between the job prospects and highly paid professions and lower wage industries. Data from the late July indicate that while jobs paying over $60,000 a year have increased substantially compared to pre-COVID levels, roughly one out of every five jobs paying less than $27,000 are still missing. Given that many of the good-paying jobs where growth is happening require specialized skills and experience, substantial support is needed for people who lost low-wage positions during the pandemic to access those opportunities. Many North Carolinians who are already struggling to make ends meet before COVID-19 can't simply drop everything so they can get the training needed to access the careers where job growth is strongest. While the headline employment rate has declined in recent months, the recovery still has not created enough jobs for everyone who wants to work. Roughly 38,000 more North Carolinians reported looking for work in July than before the COVID-19 outbreak. The worst job losses persist in many low-wage industries. The COVID-19 recession has devastated workers in some industries, while others have almost fully recovered. The largest persistent job losses since February of 2020, that's prior to the start of COVID-19, have occurred in industries like accommodation and food service, with a loss of about 45,600 jobs, education and health services, with a loss of 33,100 jobs, and arts, entertainment, and recreation, with a loss of 10,100 jobs. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.